This is an ABC podcast.
Fa'atalofa tu malo tau mai pompongini, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. As always, we'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. A lot to get through today. Why is Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rabuka distancing himself from a Chinese businessman? Facebook will remove the news tab on its app in Australia. And what does that mean? Well, it's less news, of course. So how will this affect our listeners in the Pacific? And Solomon Islands' relationship with China is the hot debate as elections near. We'll have more on those stories shortly. And remember, once our show is done, they will go up online. Simply type Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine for you to replay. And you can share these stories across your social media platforms. Remember to visit our ABC Pacific page on Facebook or Instagram. And as always, we welcome your feedback. I'm Aggie Tupong, and this is Pacific Beat. We start in Fiji, where the Prime Minister Sitiveni Rabuka has distanced himself from a Chinese businessman who's been placed on a priority watch list by Australia's intelligence agencies. Businessman and hotelier Shao Fulgang was the subject of a media investigation by Australia's Nine Network and the Organised Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. The Fiji citizen was accused of being a political operative for the Chinese Communist Party and of being involved in criminal activities. But Mr. Rabuka told ABC's Lede Mavono he's unaware of the allegations.
As far as his alleged role as an operative of the Communist Party of China, I do not know. I do not have the facility nor the role to find out who is operating in the interest of which organizations in the world. I am Minister for Foreign Affairs, and I deal with the embassy of the People's Republic of China. We have a very good relationship with the People's Republic of China.
Are you concerned at all over allegations that he is a person of interest in the intelligence community or in the criminal intelligence community of our neighbours? I appreciate that you've said that you don't have the capacity to address any such concerns or any suspicions which may happen. But can you tell us if you're personally worried that someone who is of interest elsewhere is operating in this country?
First of all, I believe he is a citizen of Fiji. So if there is an interest on a Fiji citizen from our neighbors, they will have to deal with it as a citizen of Fiji, and apply the international protocols that apply.
What are those protocols, sir?
Well, there is a... we have the... what is the term that when we have a person of interest who has been suspected of some criminal activities here, that we can ask a neighboring territory for them to be repatriated for legal processes. Whether we go to that extent or not depends on how seriously they look at this, and depending on the crimes they allege that he might have committed, are they crimes against their in their jurisdiction or international or what?
With regards to the agreement that your government reviewed early into your taking office, the Home Affairs Minister has since announced the reinstatement of that agreement to continue to have defense and security partnerships with China. What is your position with regards to that agreement? I'm sensing a difference between how you view it and how the Home Affairs Minister views it.
It was not disagreed. The agreement remains. We looked at the various aspects of it. One of them was that having officers from the Chinese police working here with our senior officers in the headquarters. That is not going. The agreement has remained in place, has remained intact. aspects of it that we put into practice are changing all the time. And we have also written in a requirement that it be reviewed every 2 years.
So the Home Affairs Minister says that the agreement will be reviewed every 6 months, but there is a particular part of the agreement that which allows an exchange. There is some concern that the exchange of personnel could lead to things that have happened in the past to the previous government under the same agreement, where security officials, police officers and defense officials from the People's Republic of China were able to come into our territory and remove people that they allege were committing crimes back home and take them back without a fair trial in this jurisdiction. What is your position on that?
My position is that there has been no disagreement or misrepresentation of what should be going on, what has gone on. The agreement is still there. The execution of the various parts of it will depend on executive authority, and that is the Prime Minister and Cabinet.
What do you say to our neighbors who worry that scenes which are now coming to light several years later of Chinese officials coming into the country possibly repeating itself?
That is their concern. As far as we're concerned, we'll have to do our own due diligence on any movements of officers, high-ranking status in that jurisdiction, and whether it is of beneficial results for us in Fiji, and it's a matter of sovereignty.
Is there ever going to be a time you think in the future that there will be Chinese security or defense officials operating out of this country?
Out of here, no. In fact, working with their own embassy is something that is in the various agreements that deal with diplomatic relationships between countries.
And that is Fiji's Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rampuka, speaking there to ABC's reporter in Fiji, Lide Movono. Now, as campaigning in Solomon Islands heats up, the country's relations with China have become a hot topic of debate. Opposition politicians have said they want to cut ties with China and return to diplomatic relations with Taiwan. But Prime Minister Manasseh Songavare's Our Party has hit out at political rivals, saying any change of status would lead to China imposing trade sanctions on the country's main exports, round logs. Politician Peter Kenneth Lorea Jr. from the United Party says the threat sounds like a bullying tactic.
Trade sanctions and all of that, I mean, that's perhaps the normal course of response that Communist China has for any country. It's not just Solomon Islands. Australia went through that as well when questioning of the origins of COVID. Next thing you know, there was no beef, no wine, you know, being exported to China. So that is the normal modus operandi. So I'm not surprised by that at all. But to do that to a small country like Solomon Islands, we're heavily dependent on China for our trade. They have been, and I think still are, our biggest trading partner. Our logs, most of our logs go there. Much of our GDP based on the logs, we're heavily dependent on that. Much of our retail sector as well. There's imports as well from China. So we are dependent in terms of trade. And that is why I'm very concerned about the over-dependency. You know, the fact that the security deal was also signed. So it meant that we were also now becoming dependent, not just economically, but security-wise. Many of these countries in the world, China is their number one trading partner, but they don't have security agreements with China. There's a balance. You have to keep that balance. For us, I don't see that balance anymore. And that's when you become dependent, then you become vulnerable, and vulnerability doesn't lead to any development when you're vulnerable, and the relationship is just based on vulnerability and an uneven partnership by a very powerful country with a small island country that's least developed. as well. It sort of sounds a bit like a bullying, you know. So it's a bullying, a threat given out to a small country by a much bigger country. I don't think there's any way to describe it from how you are saying that this is a bullying tactic that's come in. And if that's the case, then, you know, that's something we'll have to deal with. And we'll go international with this and make everybody know that a small island country is being bullied by one of the superpowers, so they claim. So, but they claim to be a superpower when it suits them, and then when it becomes another thing, they say they're a developing country. So you don't know where they sit, where their real positions are, and that's disingenuous, you know, for a partner who can't even tell us whether they're a developed country, a superpower, or a developing country. And it's a kind of a crazy situation to be in. But that is a normal modus operandi, I would say, in terms of China doing what they do when they want to get their way. And it's unfortunate, but that's the reality.
And that's Peter Kinilaria Jr., Solomon Islands politician, speaking there to ABC's Chris Narita Almanuleong. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to Vanuatu, where a government delegation is heading to the island of Santo to investigate claims against a Chinese logging company. The company has been accused of illegally cutting down trees, with photos of its workers dressed in Chinese military uniforms sparking outrage last year. As Leia Loanbu reports, the controversy surrounding the company continues to grow, along with pressure for the government to act.
Vanuatu Forest Industry Limited was allowed to enter Santo and fell trees damaged 4 years ago by Tropical Cyclone Harold. But concern that the company was cutting down trees not affected by the cyclone sparked an uproar and the suspension of a forestry official. Timothy Tomokona, the Director General of the Ministry of Forestry, says a government team is heading to the island to investigate.
Yes, I can confirm that the director of forestry is currently suspended, and his suspension is linked to the logging operation that is happening on the island of Santo. We have received reports that there is a lot of trees that have been felled and are collected at a couple of ports or anchorage in preparation for export. We have received those reports, but we have not got full information on the operation. I'm going down with another couple of senior officials to confirm those facts, and then we can advise the government on its next course of action.
Vanuatu Forest Limited, which is owned by a naturalized citizen of Vanuatu, has not responded to Pacific Beat's request for comments. But people on Santo say a large area of tree on the northeastern part of the island have been harvested since last year. Chief Watur Songi Malon Petel says they're still waiting for compensation for the trees.
The company has been resisted and got some agreements with the government, but with the custom owners, I think that's not a good idea, which is we've got the investors and the government doing agreement without the custom owners. About the process of the payment, I think it's better to certify that the custom owners or who was the partners from the registered investors. I think it's better to find it out whether they're probably the real custom owners or what. It's better to find out whether the right people. Like, I am also blaming the area where the the logging was taking place out at Madanda's area. What we've heard about that the company handles the area to cut all where the cyclone must have been blown down, I think that's not true. The logging has been made by all the trees that have been standing out in there, and also they've been damaged all the smaller trees out there as well.
Vatu Molisa, an environmentalist and liaison officer with the Santo Sunset Environment Network, says the government must take action.
All the livelihoods of our communities, especially rural communities living in Vanuatu, who depend about 80% depend on these natural resources to give them food, water, shelter, And if these sort of practices continue, it's going to be very detrimental to our environment. And from an environmental standpoint, this is should be stopped. Authorities concerned should be stopping these practices. These companies that have been issued their licenses should be stopped, and for themselves to be sent out.
The Director General of Forestry says they'll investigate the allegation and come down hard on the company if it has violated its agreement with the government.
Any possible course of action will also have to be in line with the Forestry Act and, of course, the requirements as outlined in the original agreement between the government and the company.
And that's Timothy Temekon, Director General of Forestry, and the reporter there was Lea Loonbu. We head to Timor-Leste, where the economy is heavily reliant on oil and gas and on the country's petroleum fund to promote development. But what happens when the oil and gas wells run dry? Some believe agriculture is the answer, one that can provide jobs for the country's youth bulge. But currently, the national government invests less than 3% of its budget in the agriculture sector. ABC's Timor-Leste reporter Vonya Vieira investigates.
Bartolomeu da Costa Suarez never told he'd be a farmer. The 20-year-old from the Bocau municipality is studying engineering, and he thought that was his path in life. But when COVID hit, this changed.
To meet my daily needs and to pay for college fees and other things, I've started investing in agriculture so that I can live independently and not be dependent on my parents.
He planted corn, eggplant, chilies, and now farm fish. His newfound passion led Bartolomeo to create a group called the Youth Farmers. But in the time, he quickly realized the challenges farmers face.
We don't make a big profit and we still struggle. So sometimes in a month we collect $50. But that also depends on luck.
For 20-year-old Rosemary da Gloria, the agriculture sector is critical to securing the country's future. Timor-Leste agriculture productivity is low compared to the other countries in the region, and she wants that to change. A social and agriculture activist, Rosemary has stabilized a hydroponic system in her community that she says protects food sources.
We are introducing the new, modern agriculture, which is also resilient to the climate change.
She is disappointed in the lack of investment from the government in the sector.
It's time to the government to really focus on the potential, the challenge, and look for the solutions.
Agriculture could also be an important source of jobs for the country's youth. About 70% of Timor-Leste population is under 35 years of age. A recent report from Oxfam estimated between 20 to 30,000 young people are entering the labor force each year. Mariano Ferreira is a researcher working with development-focused NGO Lau Hamutu. He says the state must allocate more funds to agriculture and other productive sector to create more employment opportunities.
Timor-Leste is a small country. Our resources are very limited. Even though we have money from oil and gas, we have petroleum, but it is very limited. Others have wide seas.
He says more investment in agriculture is vital if the government wants a sustainable economy.
If we are not serious in this field, and one day if our oil runs dry, we'll face big problems sustaining our development in this country.
Last year, the state budget allocated about $29 million to the agriculture ministry. This year, that rose slightly to $30 million, but it is still just 2.2% of the budget. Martino Laurentino is the Director General for Agriculture.
In the list of Timor-Leste government, agriculture is one of the priorities, but the amount allocated for the Ministry of Agriculture is small. But anyway, we are focused now on rice production, and we are dealing with tractors.
Experts also point to malnutrition as another reason for greater agricultural investment. Almost 50% of children under 5 are stunted, and the country has high rates of obesity due to unhealthy diets. Rosemary Da Gloria is hopeful things will change soon.
Agricultural potential is very high in Timor, but it's not really attract young people to really work on that.
And that's Rosemary Da Gloria ending that report by ABC's Timor-Leste reporter Vonya Vieira.
Are you wanting to break your betel nut addiction, zumba your way to a fitter you, or get on top of that excruciating case of gout? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has you covered. Pacific Pulse seeks out experts, movers and shakers, and aunties and uncles from across our region to bust open our health issues, challenge taboos, and separate fact from fiction. Join host Melissa Macon on Pacific Pulse Wednesday at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, from next month, Facebook will remove the news tab on its app in Australia, reducing users' access to news stories. Meta, the parent company of Facebook, says it will stop paying Australian media publishers because news isn't what users come to see on the platform. So how will this impact on users here in Australia and those in the Pacific who read stories published by Australian media? To help gauge the impact of this move, we have researcher Jopet Tarai from the Australian National University joining us this morning. With that, I say bulavanaka, Jopet.
Zayandavanaka.
Thank you for joining us this morning. Jopet, look, we know across the globe and even in the Pacific, fewer and fewer people are reading the newspapers, watching TV, or even maybe listening to the news on the radio. What impact will this decision by Facebook have access will have on access to news stories?
Thank you for that. I just want to clarify to your audience that, you know, part of what I'm going to share is a part of the research work that I've done for the last, better part of the last decade, and is part of, in some extension, to my PhD at the moment. So it's very fascinating. It could equally as frightening as it can be. The implications for Australia particularly is the fact that people will not be able to access news pieces. This a similar aspect had happened in 2021, which sparked this particular agreement. And the basis for that has been, from the Australian side, that Facebook makes, I think, somewhere around $5 billion dollars out of advertising revenue. And so that led to the licensing agreement in 2021 under the Scott Morrison government. So if this goes ahead, the similar aspect of what had happened in 2021, where news organizations or news outlets will not be able to disseminate their obviously news pieces on Facebook in Australia, will limit a lot of the access that especially Australians typically would have access to. And that can have a variety of implications on the way in which access to information, measured information, rigorously reviewed information, and all those media ethics sort of informed information for Australians.
Interesting enough, you say that Facebook makes about $5 billion off of advertising. I would say most users would prefer less advertising and probably more news. Would that be the case?
Typically that is the argument, but of course we have to understand that it's also a social networking site. So there's also a mixture of entertainment. I think some of the news pieces, or if not accounts, read of the fact that the social networking giant is arguing that only 3% makes for news on its platform, but 3% over the most populated social networking site in the world, that is significant. Of course, again, this depends on who you talk to from a business perspective or whether it be from the news organizations, but certainly it would be a really difficult situation, because if we get a situation where a lot of this is dominated by conspiracy theories and not informed rigorously reviewed information, you could see the rise of misinformation, disinformation, and the contentions around that that we saw during COVID-19 and various other particular parts of the world where this led to particular disruptions. Some even argue that the Trump era was marked by this lacking balanced information that the news serves in purpose of the public interest.
Mm. So again, this is going to affect what's happening in Australia. But, you know, the likes of how it should affect Pacific social media users, should they be worried? Because, you know, let's look to Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands. There's a very vibrant and active community on Facebook. What happens when that news element is no longer there?
So this is a very interesting thing, I must admit. Interesting, but also I think different policy thinkers and makers across the Pacific would probably need to pay close attention to this. There are three things that, based on the research, that could happen and what I've been thinking about for the last couple of weeks. The first thing is I think this could create an inadvertent advantage for newsrooms based in the Pacific. Because if this is the case for Australian newsrooms, then this could be an opportunity for Pacific-based news organizations to flourish, to report on their issues from within the Pacific, and perhaps this can compel policymakers in Canberra, in Wellington, to be a bit more consistent in their support for media, journalists, newsrooms of the Pacific, who have seen and viewed in a very interesting way, if not frustrated way, of how development assistance is always targeted towards defense, militarization, and other security interests. And issues around media communications, the protection of the media has not necessarily been something that has been consistent. So this could create that advantage. The second aspect to this is, I think this feeds into the geopolitical escalation. And you mentioned PNG and Solomon Islands. I did a paper in collaboration with one of our co-authors in 2022. One of the things, data points that I found very fascinating in the lead up to the elections in Papua New Guinea was the fact that in amongst the most visited news sites on Facebook for Papua New Guineans, EMTV, the other one that was registered was the Chinese state media, China Xinhua news page. And I have to say, at the time, I was really confused. I didn't see ABC, I didn't see Pacific Beat registering in our analytics, which is part of what we use. And it got me thinking over the fact that this could open up a particular vacuum in the region that I think might have an implication on not only Australia's soft power, but a particular side's soft power in the region. And again, you know, to what extent is this evolving? There hasn't been really enough resource support for research in this area to confirm or explore this. The third and final point to this is it's important to recognize that there's a connection between Australia and the region insofar as the Boy Declaration and, of course, the 2050 strategy around cybersecurity. There isn't really much examination over digital political implications of social media giants and the contention it has with states and how that might have an implication on cybersecurity interests in the region, considering the escalating geopolitics. So I think it's going to be very fascinating, but at the same time, quite frightening for some policy thinkers and policymakers.
Chope, is there any possibility that this could be reversed in any way?
Well, I think that will depend on government, more specifically the Australian government, and what and how it will negotiate. Because in the Scott Morrison government, the negotiations, as far as I understand it, and what has been publicly disclosed, went into the 11th hour to settle an agreement with a social networking giant. Now, that will, I think, will depend on those key policymakers and, of course, the leaders of government, what they will decide and how they will negotiate this. But, of course, it does raise a particular concern of whether our states who are beholden to the people, regardless of what country, can effectively represent us to social networking giants. So the power of social networking giants is really something that I think we have to come to terms with. And that's going to be something that everybody's going to be watching in the next couple of weeks.
And that is probably it. It is a matter of just a wait and see, isn't it?
Yes, very much, very much.
Chope, look, we appreciate your time this morning. Thank you very much for giving us a little bit of an insight into this. Vinaka. That is Chope Tarai, researcher at the Australian National University, here on Pacific Beat. Thanks for joining us here on Pacific Beat with myself, your host, Eggy Thubol, as we head around the region now. It's your news wrap time, brought to you by producer Mackenzie Smith, that I say, morena.
Morning, Eggy.
Thank you for joining us this morning. Mackenzie, really interesting story, the first one, in Kiribati. The Australian-born High Court Judge David Lambourne has once again appeared in court. What's happened?
Yeah, so for context, the Kiribati government first suspended David Lambourne 2 years ago, accusing him of breaching the constitution there. It then tried to extradite him, but a Fiji Airways pilot refused to take Lambourne against his will. And then three remaining judges blocked his deportation order. And after that happened, the government suspended those judges, leaving the country without any functioning courts. So in the 2 years since then, Lambourne has effectively been in limbo in Kiribati, where he's married to the opposition leader. But Reuters reports that he appeared in court on Tuesday as part of a legal challenge against his removal from office. Lawyers for Lambourne also disclosed at the hearing that the government has appointed a new tribunal to investigate Lambourne, and they're expected to deliver a report to Parliament next month. The High Court Commissioner Almoro Amten on Tuesday reserved his judgment.
Yeah, well, we shall wait and see what the result is of that. Thank you for that, Mackenzie. Fiji's Prime Minister, he's weighed in on the case of American guava growers. What has he said?
Yeah, so this comes after a group of American guava growers said it had produced the first locally grown crop, in the continent, with the hopes of serving the lucrative US market on an industrial scale. It's sparked a lot of attention in Fiji, and now the Fiji Times reports that the Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rambuka, says Fijian kava exporters will have to up their game if they want to compete. He says the appearance of an American grower is likely to make an impact on Fiji if local farmers don't move away from subsistence growing and relying on domestic and Fijian diaspora customers. Rambuka says producers should look further afield, including to marketing kava as a non-chemical therapeutic.
Mm. Yeah, look, the story of kava, that's going to be a continuous conversation we're going to have, Mackenzie. So I appreciate you bringing our headlines for this morning. We'll do it the same thing tomorrow.
Sounds good.
No worries. That is producer Mackenzie Smith with our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that honours that tradition, allowing you to hear in-depth personal stories from sports people to farmers, artists to teachers, activists to entrepreneurs, with one thing in common: their Pacific heritage and a unique and incredible story to tell. Stories from the Pacific, Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. If you were with us earlier, we were talking about the upcoming elections there in Solomon Islands. So let's switch our attention back to that. In little under a month's time, Solomon Islanders will head to the polls to cast their votes to elect their members of parliament. In the lead up to the April 17 vote, campaigning has been in overdrive.
I want to hear you say, for change, are you ready? Here we go, united. United?
No change!
And last time, united?
No change!
Oh, that sounds so good, yeah?
There have been calls for a change of government, but it will be an uphill battle with Manase Songavare's Our Party holding 36 of the country's 52 MPs in the last parliament. Whether or not MPs will make it back into parliament comes down to how voters cast their ballots on election day. One person who's been an avid watcher of Solomon Islands voting behaviour is researcher Dr. Terence Wood from the Australian National University. With that, I say good morning, Terence.
Good morning. How are you?
I am good, thank you. Thank you for joining us this morning. If we head to Solomon Islands and what is happening with the elections, how long, firstly, have you actually been researching Solomon Islands elections?
I started studying them in 2010, so it's been a while now.
Yeah. And what makes April's election possibly different from what you've seen in the past?
Well, I guess the main thing that makes it potentially different is the new Cold War in the Pacific and the degree of international interest in what's going on. Obviously, we've got both China and Australia watching the election and its outcomes very keenly and eager to see what is going to happen.
Well, let's talk voter turnout. Are Solomon Islanders keen to participate in elections? I mean, what do past data tell us?
Yes, in the last two elections in which we had reasonably accurate electoral rolls, the turnout was over 85%. So voting isn't compulsory in Solomon Islands, yet people vote in high numbers. They vote enthusiastically. And the reason why they do that is because if they don't vote for a particular candidate, that candidate won't help them after the election.
Terence, can I ask then, because it's not compulsory, do you think it should be then made compulsory?
Not in Solomon's, no. I mean, the turnout's already 85%, so they really don't have a problem with low turnout.
All right. So over the past month, I know there's been buzz of activity of political parties holding big launches and events. We had Manasseh Songavari's Our Party travelling across the country holding events in Malaita and the Western Province. And then you've got United Party and the Kia Coalition. They've been doing the same. But do Solomon Islanders vote along party lines?
The short answer to that question is no. Voters don't really vote along party lines at all. But almost all voters choose who to vote for based on local interests. So they vote for the MP they think will be most likely to provide them, their family or their community with direct material support. And we've seen Songavari in the past try and campaign for his party around the country, and that hasn't been particularly successful in having his candidates elected.
Thank you for that. If you've just tuned into Pacific Beat, we're speaking to researcher Dr. Terence Wood from the Australian National University on the voting behaviour of Solomon Islanders as we near the election day of April 17th. What's the turnover rate, though, for MPs? I know in the last election, 2019, can we know how many MPs made it back into office?
So once upon a time, the turnover rate was about 50%. These days, though, in the last two elections, nearly three quarters of MPs who defended their seats were re-elected in the elections. So, it's probably reasonable to expect. I'm a little torn as to what to expect in this election, but I suspect a reasonable share of the current parliament will be sitting in parliament again after this election.
I'd like to switch to the fact that even with the 19 women who contesting this year's national election, because in the previous elections, what have been voters' attitudes towards women?
It's really, really tough for women candidates in Solomon Islands, and it's not necessarily a question of voter attitudes so much as that it's harder for women to get access to the sorts of money that you need to campaign successfully in elections in Solomon Islands. And it's also harder for women to get access to influential local supporters, which is another essential ingredient if you want to be a successful candidate. So just like Papua New Guinea, throughout the Western Pacific, it's a hard place for women to get elected.
And based then on past behaviour, Terence, how do we expect voters to cast their votes come April 17th?
Well, that's a good question. It's an interesting one. I mean, we are seeing a stronger party presence this time round. And as you said, we've got Manasseh Songavari out and campaigning for his party around the country. Also, Peter Kenilorea Jr. And it's possible that voters might vote along party lines a little bit more in this election, perhaps in parts of Malaita and perhaps in parts of Honiara. There will be some backlash against Songavari and his Our Party, but I think that in general people will vote the same way in this election, so vote in search of candidates who they think are likely to help them, their family or their community of those candidates are elected, and not really consider parties or national issues in this election. I don't think things will change that much.
But Terence, if there is the likelihood of things to change, what are the priorities that you think Solomon Islands are looking towards?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, if things change, and remember I said that I don't think things will change that much, you know, perhaps there could be a bit of a backlash against Sogavare for moving, changing allegiance and becoming an ally of China. Possibly in some parts of Honiara, maybe people would reward him for the success of the Pacific Games. Those sorts of things could influence people, but I don't think, certainly particularly outside of Honiara and outside of some parts of Malaita, I don't think they're going to have much of an influence. For the average person in Solomon Islands, international issues in particular don't have an impact on their lives. So why would that change the way that they vote?
Thank you for that, Terence. We really appreciate your time this morning and just giving us an insight into the upcoming elections.
Great. Thank you very much.
No worries. That, of course, is researcher Dr. Terence Wood from the Australian National University here on Pacific Beat.
Tune in to SBS Samoa News on ABC Radio Australia. SBS Samoa News features independent news and stories connecting you to life in Australia and Samoan-speaking Australians by our friends at SBS Australia. SBS Samoa News. Tune in Mondays and Thursdays at 6:05 a.m. Samoan time for 1 hour of news in the Samoan language on ABC Radio Australia.
It's been a very full-on morning, but that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories. Fiji's Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rabuka, says he was unaware a Chinese businessman in Fiji had been placed on a priority watch list by Australia's intelligence agencies.
As far as his alleged role as an operative of the Communist Party of China, I do not know. I do not have the facility nor the role to find out who is operating in the interest of which organizations in the world.
And that's Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rabuka. To find more on these stories, you simply type Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine for you to replay, and you can share these stories across your social media platforms. And remember, always great to see you. Visit our ABC Pacific page on Facebook or Instagram. We really do welcome your feedback. But again, I'll be back same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next, and then you'll be joined by the boys, Michael Chow and Jacob McCoy, with Nisha Daly. Until then, we appreciate your time. We'll be back again 6 a.m. I did already say that, didn't I? Until then, otua o whaatu. This is Pacific Beat.